Hey gang, this week's episode is proudly brought to you by Newspapers.com, the ultimate playground for uncovering the grand slam moments of baseball's past. If you're a fan of the game, you're about to step into a time capsule of home runs and heroes. Newspapers.com lets you relive the glory days with nearly a billion pages of historical newspapers, capturing the crack of the bat, the roar of the crowd, and the unforgettable stories that define baseball history. Explore your favorite teams and players in papers nationwide dating back to baseball's beginnings in the 1840s. For our baseball-loving listeners, Newspapers.com has really knocked it out of the park with a special offer. Use the code GSA20 for an exclusive 20% discount on your subscription. That's promo code GSA20 on Newspapers.com. It's your front row seat to the stories that made baseball the timeless sport we love. And now, here's our show.
Baseball is considered America's pastime. There's just something about taking your kids to the ballpark, eating a hot dog, teaching them the game, passing along knowledge to another generation. For some, that experience may take hours to get to, but for those who grew up in the Germantown neighborhood in Nashville, that experience was just a few blocks away.
Well, it starts back when it was known as Athletic Park. It was Nashville's baseball home. And I think an interesting story to that, getting its name, Sulphur Dell, goes back to Grantland Rice, the dean of American sports writers, was a sports writer in Nashville for the Tennessean.
Sulphur Dell was the home of numerous baseball teams, from recreational to professional, including the Negro Leagues.
It was the home for baseball teams in the 19th century, not just in the 20th century. And as we moved into the 20th century, the African-American teams formed and played games here. The Nashville Elite Giants, Tom Wilson's ball team. It was easy access, easy to get to, and the community supported it, whether it was white or black. They all wanted to play here.
Charles Strobel used to walk a few blocks from his 7th Avenue home to catch games as a youngster.
You heard all those sounds, and I said, Mama, what is this? And she said, yeah, it's down there every night. I said, can I go? And she said, well, if you go with somebody. Well, I knew I could do that, get a bunch of kids in the neighborhood. And that was the first time I really began to follow baseball.
Right. But how much did you have to pay for a ticket, do you remember?
Well,
Or did you pay for a ticket?
Well, at the seventh inning, they opened the gate.
Right.
And latecomers or people wanted to leave early, they left.
Yep.
Well, and I went in through, usually free.
Some of the game's most famous names played at Sulphur Dell. Henry Aaron started his pro career in Nashville when he played for the Indianapolis Clowns of the Negro American League. And Jackie Robinson with the Kansas City Monarchs before coming back for exhibition games with the Dodgers after he broke the color barrier in Major League Baseball. But in 1964, baseball moved out of Sulphur Dell, and the ballpark was torn down in 1969.
Welcome to Good Seats Still Available, a curious little podcast devoted to exploring what used to be in professional sports. Here's your host, Tim Hanlon.
Hey now, how are you everybody? It's your pal Tim Hanlon, and it's Good Seats Still Available. We are back once again for our little excursion, our little journey, our little exploration to what used to be in professional sports. Thank you for finding us. Happy to have you along, and happy to be going into more baseball stuff because the spring training scenarios are just about close to winding up. We've already had a couple of actual regular season games. I'll be it in Korea, but we are, as we drop this episode, on the cusp, if not already in your town, of the regular season beginning. Happy to use that as an excuse to welcome our guest this week, Chris Epting. And it's a little bit of a deep dive into the bookshelf here at Good Seats Still Available. And the book that we pull out of our crate this week is called Roadside Baseball. And you baseball fans out there may know of this book. It's been around, well, it's in its third edition now, which came out a couple of years ago. I want to say it was 2019 or so. But the book dates back to, I think the original version was in the 1990s, if I'm not mistaken. And it is the current version even though it's 5 years old, and arguably has a few more updates to probably come, as you'll hear in this conversation. It's a Bible, if you will, and a must-have reference book for the baseball fan out there, especially the fan that enjoys the game all across the country and the various nooks and crannies of the game, whether it be top-tier Major League Baseball or the most minor of minor leagues, the independent leagues, the wooden bat leagues during the summer, whatever. This book, in all its various editions, forwarded by the great baseball voice of Joe Buck, not in his voice. Well, if there was an audio version of it, perhaps there would be. But Chris has lovingly crafted this book over the years through three editions of essentially the sort of quintessential American pastime meeting the equally quintessential wanderlust, I guess, of the American automobile. And there's more than almost 600 or so various events in baseball history that are found sort of in roadside America kind of fashion in this book. I mean, and if you want to find things that used to be, I mean, we're going to be this is a story that's chock full of those with respect to baseball. And one of those is encapsulated in our little audio there to begin. That's from the Nashville Stars, which, if you're not familiar, is the official organization that has been founded and put together. It's Music City Baseball, I think, is the official name of the group, to lure either an expansion franchise or a relocated franchise for Major League Baseball into Nashville. And the story there is about a little bit of Nashville's baseball history, which is actually pretty significant. In particular, for those of a certain age may know of a place that used to be called Sulphur Dell. And a fascinating ballpark, and you have to look it up to sort of truly appreciate it, had an area in right field, a short right field, called the Dump. And what the Dump was essentially a hill, 45-degree embankment for the entire right field section of the ballpark. And among other idiosyncrasies was the place where Nashville played its baseball of the minor league variety through pretty much the early 1960s. And now, actually, on that footprint generally, is where the current minor league Nashville Sounds play at First Horizon Park, which was literally created in the shadow and in the footprint of this park known as Sulphur Dell. And it's a fascinating story. You heard a couple of voices in there, a guy named Chris Bacon, who's part of the Nashville Stars organization, Skip Nipper, who's a well-known historian, especially around that ballpark, and a guy named Charles Strobel, who grew up in that neighborhood. And true to this roadside baseball book, you'll see in the earlier versions, before the current ballpark was created, there was a marker. Literally, was the only remnant of the Sulphur Dell experience. And for a while, it was a former site because it was, I think, if I'm not mistaken, a parking lot for a long time that was used by state of Tennessee workers. But now that that marker is somewhere on the grounds now of the relatively new stadium there, First Horizon Park in Nashville, on the bet that, which I'm sure will require a new baseball park, if the majors come a calling. But that's just a little bit of a tidbit. That's just one quick example of the various roadside attractions one can find. And this book literally is it's kind of a guidebook for any fan that wants to sort of travel the country or different parts of the country. And, for example, find where Larry David's softball team played in an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm. He gets that specific. Perhaps you'd like to find the exact location of Mickey Mantle's legendary 565-foot blast that broke the record books. The baseball field where many believe that Babe Ruth hit the longest home run of his career against Walter Johnson back in the day. Yeah, all kinds of stuff. Negro leagues, minor leagues, certainly major league ballparks of the past, like the various polo grounds, plural, all that kind of stuff sits inside this now third edition update and expanded of Roadside Baseball. And we're going to get into the story of creating the book, what drove this to sort of come into play, and just a little fascinating insight into the author of Chris Epting, who's done a whole bunch of other stuff too, which we'll get to as well. The book, again, is called Roadside Baseball, The Locations of America's Baseball Landmarks. It's a fun read, even if you don't travel. But if you do travel, boy, oh boy, put this in the glove compartment. It is published by Santa Monica Press. And you can find a copy for yourself by going through our website at goodseatsstillavailable.com, searching up this episode number 343 with Chris Epting. And you'll find a couple of convenient links to the book. You can get it in paperback or Kindle version, or you can even find some of the older versions if you'd like, the first and second editions, for if you're into that kind of thing. And we'll get a couple of shekels of referral love, and you know we appreciate when you do that. That's, I guarantee you, if you don't already have it, you should get it. And I think you'll find it a nice accoutrement, shall we say, for any springtime or summertime travels that you have coming up. You will want to have this nearby to just see if your journey will take you nearby a spot remembered or forgotten in baseball history. All right, so let's not waste any more time. Let's get into this this fun chat with Chris. We had this about a month and a half ago. I'm sorry it took this long to get this to you. But you will enjoy him and it, whether you have the book or not. And please, as always, enjoy. Why don't you start with a little bit of background about you and your just prodigious authorship of so many different books and different sort of dynamics. Give our audience a little sense for stuff that you do besides this baseball thing we're going to talk about.
Well, I thank you, first of all, Tim. Thanks for having me and for that generous setup. I've written a lot of books about travel and baseball and pop culture and music, and I co-write memoirs with people. Dozens, probably almost 50 books I've written. But I will tell you that Roadside Baseball, I get asked a lot about which books resonate the most for me. And if I had to pick one, I really think Roadside Baseball, it's the one I always wanted to write. Because when I was a kid, the first time I went to Cooperstown at about 11 years old, which would have been about 1971, 72 or so, I went looking for a book that would trace historic baseball places. I loved history. I loved old baseball photos. And that book didn't exist. And soon after, I decided I wanted to be a writer. And in my head, I thought, when I get older, I'm going to write that book. And so when the book, the first edition came out 20 years ago, when I got asked to go speak at Cooperstown about it, it was really a full circle thing for me, because my son at that point was about 11, so that same age, and he was there. And, you know, it was a really thrilling thing for me, because I love the game of baseball, but I really love the places. I love the geography of it. And a lot of that stemmed from the fact that when I was a kid, one of the first players I started reading about was Babe Ruth. I grew up in New York, and I was a Mets fan, but a Yankee Stadium fan. And there was something about Yankee Stadium.
Well, wait a minute. Well, actually, I'm from the New York area too. How do you do that balance? Because I have a similar kind of
story. Okay, a good question. I mean, okay, I want to hear yours. For me, I had a lot of family members who were from Brooklyn and who had been, you know, longtime Dodger diehards. And of course, when the Dodgers left, they needed a National League team. So I was sort of automatically ushered into the Mets. And the Yankees were sort of like the evil empire. But I had all these old baseball books, and so many of the photos, you could see the old Yankee Stadium. And I had, I think it was either a Little League team or a day camp. We went to Yankee Stadium. That was the field trip. And I was kind of hesitant, because Shea Stadium was like, and I'm probably 11 or so. And Shea Stadium, I was loyal, you know, I was a loyal Mets fan. And there was something about walking into Yankee Stadium that changed my life. The old original Yankee Stadium, when I could all of a sudden picture all of those old images, you know, and the old facade, the frieze that ran around you know, the circumference of the stadium. And that did it for me. So I would kind of split my allegiances in that I wasn't a Yankee fan. There were Yankee players I liked. I loved Bobby Mercer and Roy White. But I would go there more to study the stadium. Whereas the Mets, it was more about going to watch the baseball. So that's how I
In other words, you're saying that Shea Stadium wasn't very much of a – Wasn't it great?
No, that was my first ball. No, look, I loved Shea Stadium. That was my very first game. And so I think your first game, you always sort of like that, whatever ballpark you go to, that's what represents baseball. And so for me, Shea Stadium was always about that. It was still fairly new. It was only like 5, 6 years old at that time. So it was lauded as sort of the, you know, modern, beautiful park. And I loved Shea Stadium. I really did. I have wonderful memories there. But again, there weren't great old photos where I could see, you know, Mickey Mantle and Babe Ruth and all these other people at Yankee Stadium. And that for me was a really big deal because I loved history. And when I learned that Babe Ruth was laid to rest, probably, I don't know, 20 minutes from my house in Westchester County, that became my first roadside baseball landmark because I went there. I couldn't believe he was there. And I left, you know, I went and got a Yankee hat and left it there. And I would do that every August 16th until I think I was in college, till I moved away. It was a very important ritual for me to go play ball in a Yankee hat all year and then bring it there and leave it there. And so Babe Ruth has always been, for me, been someone I'm just completely fascinated by, always have and always will be. But that's going to his grave is what I think also planted the seed for this book, in addition to that trip to Cooperstown. So early on, I wondered, I would ask my father, what's where the polo grounds used to be? What's where Ebbets Field used to be? It started with ballparks and then eventually branched out. When I would travel, I would go find anything related to baseball history, whether it was a birthplace, a place of death, a ballpark, whatever it was, you know, a business a guy, a player might have run. I would go track it down and tell the story. And then eventually, like I said, about just over 20 years ago, the first edition came out. And for me, it was a dream come true, you know, to have Ken Burns write part of the foreword and Joe Buck. Like there were a lot of good names that liked the book that associated themselves with it, which I was very flattered by as well. So it just felt, you know, it felt like it was worth all the research and stuff that you go through when you're writing a, you know, a very fact heavy book like that.
Why the fascination and the approach to sort of find and mark, I guess, these landmarks and why baseball? In particular?
Well, Ken Burns called it, and I met him once and we were talking about this, and he said, your book, I consider your book Baseball's Stations of the Cross.
Now, I totally agree. But
and I'm raised a Catholic, so I get that reference like head sure. on, you know? And I thought, that's really what it is. You're paying homage to these places. And look, baseball, we can debate what sports are the most culturally relevant. But for me, baseball will always be the one that's easiest for most people to relate to. Anybody can throw a ball. You know, baseball players always look like kind of regular people. You know what I mean? Whereas football and hockey players always sort of overdeveloped. But baseball players, you know, especially back then, you know, looked like just people that you were in your neighborhood. And that I think that made it very relative for people. But baseball was just a generational sport that a nation, you know, was held together by. And you grew up understanding baseball with aunts and uncles and grandparents and siblings and males, you know, boys and girls. You know, everybody wanted to be close to the game. And I think that's what makes it special for me is that it's emblematic. You know, the national pastimes become a cliche, but it really is woven into our country's fabric, I think, on a different level than any other sport. And that's why I think to me, baseball transcends being just a sport. It's more a way of life, you know, at least it was in our country. And that's the spirit that I was writing from.
I think it's also, there are plenty of other sports, as we've learned and as history has sort of laid out that, you know, were as old, if you will, and sometimes even predates that of baseball, right? But I think there's no sport in American culture and history that has been more written about.
No.
And historical eyes foisted upon than baseball, right? I mean, the Ken Burns documentary, obviously iconic in all of it, but some would argue maybe it's perhaps too much written about relative to its relative popularity against other sports. But I'm not sure that's the correct answer because it's so intertwined. I mean, yes, it's the national pastime and all that sort of, that good stuff. But the reality is that the history of the country and the history of the sport are so, they mimic each other. And
they're completely intertwined. And that led to, you know, stories when players would go to war. You know, we knew all about those stories. You know, and you look at what Ted Williams would do, you know, during battle and Bob Feller. And they'd come back and just resume, you know, where they had been, Joe DiMaggio. And I think that, you know, we were very aware as a country of those stories, which helped it. But yeah, to your point, it's always been very intertwined. And again, the simplicity of it, it's throwing a ball and it's hitting something with a stick. You know what I mean? It's so basic that anybody can pick it up. You know, I loved hockey as a kid and played a little bit, but not everyone can go get skates and go play hockey. You know what I mean? Or football, you need pads. Baseball is pretty simple. You know, anybody can, you can make shift a baseball game or a stickball game or whatever it used to be pretty easily. And I think that also helped it become so embraced because it didn't really deny anybody.
All right, you've done three editions of this book, Roadside Baseball. The most recent one was 2019. But let me go back. Let's go back to the first one. Mm-hmm. Can you walk us through sort of the ideation of it? What was going on in your life at the time? And maybe even a little insight as to how you were going to go about to do it. Like, did you have a catalog in your head or was it going to be random or what?
Well, that's a good question. I had been over the course of my, you know, professional life, I wrote and directed commercials at that point before I started writing books in my 20s and 30s. But whenever I would travel, I would always go track down baseball sites. And so I was cataloging it more as a hobby. Then in the late 80s, I met a friend, an actor named Fred Willard. I don't know if you remember Fred Willard.
Oh, my God, of course.
And I met Fred
tonight and all those things.
Everything. And I was
in company. And yeah,
exactly. And I was as big a Fred Willard fan as you could be at that point, because I grew up with those shows you mentioned. And I'd always felt Fred was just the funniest person in the world. And we met at this function and it was just completely serendipitous. But we wound up I forget how it came up, but we wound up not just talking about baseball, but his obsession with tracking down former ballpark sites. And I said, you got to be kidding. I said, we've been living the same life. And he goes, let's meet tomorrow. I want to take you to Burbank, to where the St. Louis Browns used to spring train. And so Fred and I spent the next day having a catch in Burbank at old Olive Memorial Park, which would soon be torn down. And Fred and I would be in there grabbing bricks to save for ourselves. And so Fred became a real inspiration because he would say, because I was getting to a point where I wanted to, you know, branch off from what I was doing in advertising and get a book together on this. And Fred was so encouraging. And he and I would take road trips to go visit, you know, former ballpark sites or to go watch games together or whatever. And he was as great a kindred spirit as you could have. And the other thing that I will say added to it was right after 9/11, when we were all, everyone's shaken to their core about how quickly things can change and how we can lose things and how it affects our memories and our cultural inspirations and things. And I thought, you know what? Nothing is safe anymore. Like, we're all on trap doors. I'm going to write this book. And it was really in the post effects of 9/11 that I thought, we just don't know what's going to happen. And I feel like we yearn for our past because everything is all of a sudden so fragile. And so I wrote a book proposal and I began shopping it and shopping it hard and found a publisher, Santa Monica Press, the first one was Sporting News actually bought it. And
remember them? Sure.
I know. And they were the first ones and they got it. And so for me, it was, and Fred was thrilled. And, you know, Fred and I would then kind of go on additional little missions, as we would call them, to find things and take photos and grab bricks and tiles and whatever else we could pry and, as he would call, liberate from their original moorings. And so it was really those two things, my friendship with Fred and coming out of 9/11, just thinking, you know what, we need to protect and preserve what matters to us as Americans.
How much did you have essentially in the tank before you kind of got the book deal together? And then how much did you kind of have to sort of immediately fill in and bump out? And then frankly, how did you go about sort of, you know, doing that? Did you just get in the car and start driving, you and Fred?
Yes, I had maybe a quarter, because when I got, and originally the book was a much simpler idea, it was only going to be stadiums, and the Sporting News was like, no, you should expand this. And that's when it really became a bigger deal. And yes, I got in the car my son and I, and the whole family, in fact, for a lot of trips, but primarily my son and I, and we go on these road trips. And I said, let's have a catch in every former ballpark. As we're doing this, let's make something out of it. Let's go, when we go to, you know, whatever field it happens to be, we'll have a catch there and talk about the history there. And it make it that kind of project as well, like a father-son project. And so we did a lot of that. And it took me about a year and a half to get it all together. And Sporting News was a great partner. They had a wonderful library that they had access to use for great photos and things, which made it special. And so that's really how it shook out that year and a half. And I would say to your question, about a quarter of it, I think, was done loosely. And then I was just so motivated to make it unlike, because there's so many baseball books. But incredibly, this book didn't exist. Like, nothing was even close to it. And I thought, here's an opportunity to really own this lane of baseball travel and, you know, offbeat Americana and all that. And thankfully, it found an audience. As soon as it came out, it was a real hit with people. And as the years went on, like, what was cool about it was, I think it inspired people to identify other sites. That's what led to all these other editions, these three other editions, was that, or two other editions, is that every, like, you know, 7 or 8 years, a lot of ballparks would be torn down and things would happen, but people would all of a sudden be commemorating things and unveiling plaques. And there was almost a sort of this roadside baseball mentality that kicked in, which predicated doing additional versions.
So would you call that crowdsourcing in today's modern sort of vernacular, or you just sort of took those suggestions and those ideas from those folks and incorporated them and sort of...
That's what I would do.
You did them yourself.
People would reach out to me with stories. I would go interview them. I would do the... I'm a research hound. So they would give me sort of a top line on something, and I would then dig into a lot of these stories and really unpack them. But then there were people themselves. There's a guy named David Stalker, who began this marker program throughout the Midwest. And I gave him a whole little chapter unto him of what he had done, to acknowledge what he had done, you know, because it was so, in those few years, he took all these dead ball era players and commemorated them and paid for new final resting places and all this. And there were these great stories of people who were out there getting this stuff done. And they had read Roadside Baseball. And so they knew who I was when I approached them. And so, you know, so it was a little bit of everything, but I'm always on the lookout for things and always. But once people get a sense of who you are and what you do, they'll reach out to you and say, hey, by the way, here's a tip. You know, so-and-so, you know, Shoeless Joe Jackson worked at this place for a year and he lived over here, whatever. And I kind of take it from there and then expound it.
Yeah, it's interesting because the stories behind, I mean, it just like the book sort of boasts, right? It says there's no story sort of too small. Some are intricate and some are, you know, somewhat fleeting, but, and others are much more substantial, but that's the tableau of baseball, right? It almost mimics that.
Totally. Yeah, totally. They're not all the same. I mean, I remember going when I had found the final resting place of Jack Norworth, who wrote Take Me Out to the Ball Game, you know, expecting there to be some grand marker monument to him in Anaheim State, in Anaheim, practically in the shadow of Anaheim Stadium, not a quarter mile away. And the woman at the cemetery, when I got there, she goes, oh, you're writing a book on baseball. Let me show you our baseball celebrity. I thought it was going to be Norworth. She had never heard of him before. And who she was talking about was Lefty Williams, who pitched for the 1919 Black Sox, which was really cool, but not. And interestingly, he was in an unmarked grave because the family would still get threats way back when he passed away, decades after the Black Sox scandal. They didn't want it known exactly where he was, which was a really incredible story. And then I found the place where Jack Norworth was, and it was this forgotten little piece of ground that you could hardly read. So I spearheaded a project to raise money. There's a marker there today that commemorates him that we unveiled, I think, in 2010. So I myself have gotten into these things as a result of Roadside Baseball. And whenever I can get involved in a project, I wrote a big article for Preservation Magazine years ago on the last remnant of the polo grounds, a staircase leading down to a landing where there was a little plaque. And that article led to the Giants, the Jets, the Mets, and the Yankees all contributing to beautify it. So, I mean, I've had this really, some great opportunities to help contribute myself to preservation of some of these sites.
Yeah. So what is that line then between, historical accuracy in writing and memorialization and advocacy? Because it sounds like it's pretty tempting on a lot of different adventures of yours, no?
Listen, anything I can do, I think it's incumbent upon this kind of project where, to me, it's an ongoing project. I want there to be a fourth edition. And then after I'm gone, a fifth edition. I want this to go on because there's always going to be sites that get created and uncovered. And I never wanted it to be just a static book. I wanted it to be sort of a living, breathing project. And so my advocacy bleeds across every page. If I hear about something, if I can help raise money for it, I do it. You know, if I can write an article, I do it, all in the spirit of protecting these places and commemorating them in a way that's meaningful, you know? And so I don't really have any lines with it whatsoever. It's not like I'm operating, you know, I wrote for the LA Times for 10 years. This isn't like that. You know, there's no real journalistic approach I've got to take. It's advocacy, storyteller, but, you know, it's got to be accurate, of course. But I make no bones about being an advocate for this stuff and getting the story right, but also trying to lend a hand where needed.
All right, what's this? Newspapers.com. Fantastic. Hey, today's podcast is proudly brought to you by Newspapers.com, the ultimate playground for uncovering the grand slam moments of baseball's past. If you're a fan of the game, you're about to step into a time capsule of home runs and heroes. Newspapers.com lets you relive the glory days with nearly a billion pages of historical newspapers, capturing the crack of the bat, the roar of the crowd, and the unforgettable stories that define baseball history. Explore your favorite teams and players in papers nationwide, dating back to baseball's beginnings in the 1840s. For our baseball-loving listeners, Newspapers.com has really knocked it out of the park with this special offer. Use the code GSA20 for an exclusive 20% discount on your subscription. That's promo code GSA20 on Newspapers.com. It's your front row seat to the stories that made baseball the timeless sport we love. Thank you, Newspapers.com, for your sponsorship of this week's episode. And now, back to our conversation.
Give me a sense of some of the, I guess, surprising discoveries that you found over the years. I think clearly that one in Anaheim was certainly sounds odd, but, you know, and hard to believe. But you must have been floored by some other ones, too, that you weren't expecting.
Yeah, one in particular that I never can get out of my head was in Hot Springs, Arkansas. And it had a lot of modern relevance recently with the pandemic, because in 1918, you know, that's when the Spanish flu, our last national pandemic. And there was spring training, of course, held there. And that was the year when the Red Sox trained there, that the Red Sox had a lot of sick players from the flu. And they had to beef up their lineup a bit. And that's where the decision was made to take this kind of upstart pitcher named Babe Ruth and make him part of the regular lineup. You know, they'd seen it. They knew his bat was strong, but they needed him to hit, you know, because they were down players. That happened in Hot Springs. But what also happened when they inserted him into the lineup, the everyday lineup, is he hit a home run at a field there, and it seems to have gone about 570 feet outside the park across the street, and the ball lands in a pool that's part of an alligator farm, one of those kind of kitschy roadside attractions. And if you go there today to Hot Springs, the park is long gone. It's a parking lot, but they've painted a white home plate where Babe Ruth would have stood. The alligator farm is still there. The pool is still there. And there's a sign in the pool that says the home run that changed baseball landed in this pool. It was, I believe, March 17th, 1918. And the alligator lived there until, you know, alligators live a long time. There was a baby alligator in the pool when Ruth's ball landed there. And I think the gator was there until 10 years ago, which is kind of crazy. But that pool, to me, again, just tied together so many aspects of American road culture and Americana and baseball and Babe Ruth. And not just Babe Ruth, but the moment where he was elevated beyond just being a pitcher into the everyday lineup, where he became the Babe Ruth that ultimately, you know, saves baseball after the scandal a year later.
So what are you looking for when you're out there on the road or in the wild looking for stuff? Are you looking for, like, for example, I'm looking at one of the call outs here, the monument, if you will, to the Morgan G. Buckley Stadium in Hartford, right? Are you looking for plaques and signs and examples of stuff that, you know, at least commemorates in some way, shape or form? Or are you kind of looking for things that are abandoned or gone or have been erased by whatever and trying to maybe recreate or somehow rebirth some kind of recollection and memory and maybe a monument or so that's not existing already?
All of it. If a lot of ballparks today have some interesting plaques and museums, wherever there's history, whether it exists or it used to exist, I like to tell the story. And if I find a parking lot and it seems like it would be a great idea for a plaque to be there, I'll write that in, you know, but it really, whether, you know, today it's a lot of if you want to go like where Babe Ruth played or, you know, other players of that era, it's really down to outside of Fenway and Wrigley in the majors, that's it. So it's down to a lot of obscure minor league parks, you know, and that's where I spend a lot of time as well. The great history is there. So it's really, you know, again, it's everything. It's the sublime to the ridiculous. It's things that are no longer there, things that have been forgotten, and also things that are still there but that maybe are on the bubble or on the cusp of not being there, or in parks today where things have happened that do have commemorative plaques and things. I'm all about plaques and markers and things like that, and little museums and little offbeat spots that aren't marked. It really doesn't matter to me. Wherever baseball brushed up against on some level, that's what I'm looking for.
Would you consider any of your any of the things that you found along the way and maybe potentially to come in the future true finds like that perhaps even the baseball hall or Sabre members didn't even know about? I mean, were there any sort of true unearthings of things that that nobody knew about until you came along?
That's a good question. Yeah, well, in a sense, a person approached me about 10 years ago, and this is in the new edition of the book. And she had an old a family home movie from 1927 with Babe Ruth and I believe her great grandfather. And it was this sort of murky, not documented trip that when Ruth used to barnstorm in the 20s, you know, in the off season, like a lot of players did. And he was in California and got dragged around by her grandfather to a couple of hunting lodges. And there's footage of him basically passed out like on a bunk in a cab, you know, really compelling stuff. And I went and traced all those sites through Riverside County to Orange County and put that together. And no one had ever done that. No one had known. It's about 3 or 4 days where he essentially disappeared off this barnstorm. He had the days off. Some games in Long Beach had been rained out, which created this opportunity for him to go carouse a little bit and go hunting and drinking with the boys, which he did. And so I did a lot of research to find these obscure hunting clubs in Riverside County and Orange County and retrace those days of Ruth's. And that was one that I was kind of proud of because that had not been documented before. And a lot of Ruth scholars were really into that because there was always kind of curiosity about where he was on that trip. And there was a lot of mythology about it. And I was using this home movie was able to really determine where those things happened. So I think that was probably the deepest one of those experiences. There have been some others too. That's a really good question. I'm going to rack my brain as we're talking here because occasionally something does come up where you feel like you've dusted it off for, if not the first time, then the first time in a long time.
How about stuff maybe that you thought you knew and were completely, you know, floored or reoriented because you stumbled onto something or you
there's you one there's one that really gave me pause. And you know, as a kid, I always remembered watching the Pride of the Yankees whenever it was on TV, and I loved the movie. I mean, the fact that Babe Ruth was in it and was really good in it, I thought was amazing. That to me made Babe Ruth a real person. But Gary Cooper's, you know, portrayal of Lou Gehrig to me was so empathetic and beautifully done that I became like a big Lou Gehrig fan as well. And there's, you know, we're all kind of taught as baseball fans that the last game happens in Detroit, pulls himself out of the lineup, and that's it, you know, at Tiger Stadium. That's the last time Lou Gehrig plays a game in a Yankee uniform, which is what I believe, like a lot of other people. But then I learned about, I guess it's 1939, and the Yankees, so bizarre back then, they would schedule mid-season exhibition games against like one of their AAA clubs. These games would come up. And Gehrig was out of the lineup at that point, but they were playing Municipal Stadium in Kansas City where the A's played. And Gehrig learned that the game had essentially sold out because he was going to be playing. And he came out of his little retirement there to play, I think, four innings in that game. And from that game, got on a train and then went straight to the Mayo Clinic where he would be diagnosed. So when I went, and it's a park today, it's just like a nice community park. And going back to that park today, thinking, you know, this is where it really happened. You know, this is the spot, was really haunting and profound for me on a very deep level. Similarly, Fred Willard was from Cleveland, and he used to go to League Park when he was a kid. And, you know, like in the 40s, I guess, when they would play day games, because they never had lights at League Park. So when both parks were operating, Municipal and League Park, the big weekend games under the lights were at Municipal, but League Park had the smaller midweek games. And I went back there once with Fred when it, and the field is still there today. And to
it's a park really, but the city took it over quite a bit. Yeah,
they acknowledge all of it, and the old ticket office is there. But back then, part of the original bleachers were there, and Fred and I kind of broke in. You know, you could get in there, and we stood in what would have been a locker room. And Fred said, "Think about who got dressed in here." You know what I mean? And that was, again, that was just incredible to think about the sounds that would have taken place in there, you know, and then to be out on the field and think about, you know, that's where DiMaggio got the last hit in the streak. You can stand at that home plate. It's where Babe Ruth hit number 500. You know, a lot of things happened there. After Ray Chapman died, you know, when they won the World Series that year, the Indians, that's where the unassisted triple play by Bill Wamsgans, you know, all those things. When you go to those old fields, to me, they're like Civil War battlegrounds almost. You can hear and feel what took place there, just the layers of history, the people that were there, the stories that were told. To me, ball fields really are like old battlefields. That's how I always feel when I visit them.
Is there a sense that, I'm curious as to, as you sort of travel around, do you find a sense of ignorance or no attention paid to some of these things, and you're sort of like incredulous and finding this out? Or I got to think that there's sometimes you're disappointed, perhaps maybe with the local upkeep, shall we say, based on what you thought and you knew going in.
I remember going first to find the field from The Sandlot in Utah, the movie The Sandlot. And it was just like this forgotten field. And I think since then, in the last year, they've paid a little more. They brought like the player, the actors back for a film anniversary, which was cool. But I remember thinking, here you've got, do any neighborhood kids here still know The Sandlot? And do they know what happened on this field? You know, the movie that was shot here. It happens once in a while where things I think could use some upkeep or a little bit of love. But you know, that takes resources too. And in a lot of cities, it's just not a priority, you know, but over time, it's funny, since the first edition came out in the 20 years, a lot of things have changed. And places that I wrote about in the first edition now, which I update in the new edition, have been acknowledged, appreciated, tended to, League Park being one of them. And it makes me happy that there's some evolution, that I think people take this stuff more seriously now.
Do you have any? So when you go to the actual ballparks, both past and present, I'm curious to how do you juxtapose, you know, the smaller locations, the minor league kind of feel and vibes with that of the majors, especially now, and you know, even 2019, the last edition, still very much. I mean, these modern, hulking, you know, luxury box filled stadiums, right, which are almost the antithesis of history and you know, and regard for the past.
Well, it's really different. I mean, look, I think now, so the third oldest ballpark today is Dodger Stadium. The fourth oldest is Angel Stadium. The fifth oldest is Oakland. I mean, all the old parks are gone, essentially. I mean, thank God for Fenway and Wrigley. But, you know, as I would go to ballparks, even today, there is, to me, kind of a homogenized experience where it begins to feel the same. I mean, look, you have some great parks like Camden that were built in a style that's indicative of an older, you know, architectural style, which I think is awesome. But a lot of the modern stuff leaves me cold. I'll give you a quick anecdotally. I, about 6 years ago, began a project with Tommy Lasorda, where I was writing his memoir with him, his last book. And I'd go visit him, you know, every week or two at his house in Fullerton. And we would just talk baseball, you know, and this went on and on. And then COVID hit and that circumvented everything. And then he got sick and he died early the next year in January of 21. But I ended up going to a lot of games with him, you know, and we would go to Dodger, which was incredible. And we'd go to Dodger Stadium, and up in the owner's booth where we would sometimes start our game, it was cold. I mean, for me, that environment was businesslike. I mean, like, the food was great. Don't get me wrong. It was very plush and very, you know, very nice experience, but it wasn't a baseball experience. I remember once there, I saw Don Newcomb sitting alone, and there was two seats together. You know how those suites will have like a couple of rows of seats? Well, he was sitting alone, Don Newcomb, and I went over, and I was getting kind of tired. There was a lot of meetings going on and stuff. And I went over to him and I said, "Mr. Newcomb, do you mind if I sit with you?" And he said, quote, "Only if you're going to watch and pay attention to the goddamn game." And I said, "I keep score. I mean, don't worry. Like, I'm a nerd. I get it." He pats the seat. "Sit down, young man." And he and I sat there and talked baseball through the whole game. You know, he was fed up with the corporate experience behind him, you know, and Tommy, similarly, we'd get out of there and Tommy liked being down in his two seats by the dugout. And he would say to me, "This is a baseball game. This is a baseball game." He goes, "Up there, it's all business. Down here is a baseball game." And I always felt the same way. You know, I don't deny the appeal of the modern day luxury experience. It's just not my favorite space. My favorite seat is second to last level behind home plate. That to me is the prime place to sit, to really watch a baseball game, even the upper deck behind home plate. That's always going to be my favorite perch.
Yeah. Look, and you mentioned Yankee Stadium and Shea Stadium earlier, right? I mean, that's you couldn't ask for a greater juxtaposition between, you know, a stadium that is so reverential to the past in the Yankee Stadium, and one that has a nod or two to the past in Citi Field, but literally is, I don't know, it feels like it's more of a carnival atmosphere, and the game just happens to be going on underneath, right?
But I think that's a lot of places. I think the game sadly has become secondary to the entertainment. I remember, I don't know if you ever read a book called A Day in the Bleachers. It's my favorite baseball book by Arnold Haino.
Sure. It's a classic book.
Oh, God, it's incredible. He went to the game where Mays makes the catch at the Polo Grounds in 1954. He's a sports writer, but he sits in the bleachers, he buys a ticket, and he writes. The book is the game. I think it's nine chapters, like nine innings.
Yep.
And it's whether you're a baseball fan or not, it's just a beautifully told story of what it was like to be there in the bleachers. And I, long story short, met him years ago and we became friends. In fact, he wrote the foreword for a book I wrote about the Polo Grounds, which was always going to be my favorite ballpark, even though I was never there. And I wrote an article for the LA Times, for the LA Times magazine, where my son and I took him to a game, oh God, 20 years ago. And it was called Back to the Bleachers. I said, "Let me buy tickets. Let's you, me, and Charlie, my son, go to a game. I want to watch a game through your eyes today and see what it's like for you today, this many years later." So we did. Went to Dodger Stadium. And even then he said to me, he goes, "Why all the distractions? Why all the noise? Why the music? Why can't we just watch the game?" He said, "There's no time." He said, quote unquote, "There's no time for reflection." He goes, "When I grew up going to a game, between innings, all you talked about was the previous inning and the inning coming up. That's what your conversation was." He goes, "They don't let you do that today because you can't hear yourself think." And that now, of course, I don't know what he would think today, but it's much more amplified. And, you know, I kind of wish they'd go back to a quieter experience where the game is the focus. You might lose a few people, but you'd get the real fans. But again, I know that's completely naive to talk in those terms. They're trying to modernize the game to make it more palatable.
It's the entertainment experience, right? I mean, I think that there is this belief, and not just baseball, but sports generally, is that it has to be an entertainment package. And hell, it, with all due respect, it doesn't even have to be a darn game going on, right? That's why Wrigley Field has been built around so extensively. Yeah. Why the Atlanta Braves, you know, is basically has an office park around it and shops and restaurants and stuff. And everybody else now wants to emulate that because it means revenues even not during game day.
No, I know. And listen, I get it. It's just really not for me. I don't like the distractions either. I can't stand being at a game between innings where you can't have a conversation with someone sitting next to you because of what's being drilled into you. You know, I get why you've got to have a lot of promotions and things. And a lot of those things do harken back, I think, to, you know, somewhere I think, you know, Bill Veeck is smiling. You know what I mean? Because a lot of the promotions and things that are, I think, you know, fall out of what he started, which is fine. I get those things. But I do think the wall-to-wall nature where every sound, every moment has to be filled with something. I don't like that because baseball to me, I always equated it with fishing. I liked fishing as a kid. And it was always like, it was about the environment as much as anything. And if you caught a fish, great. But even if you didn't, like if you don't see a home run, the environment and the experience is just so rich and rewarding on its own. It didn't need a lot of activity. And that's to me what baseball always was. You know, when I think about going to games as a kid and just talking to my dad about baseball and smelling cigars and beer at Yankee or Shea, I loved that. You know, that to me was a big part of the experience.
Anything that's eluded you in your investigations, your travels, things that you've been looking for, you've heard about, you thought existed, couldn't find? Anything that sort of is sort of out there still in your mind that you haven't been able to check the box for yet?
If I could find the Eddie Grant, who was the first World War One player in World War One to be killed, there was a plaque on the wall at the old Polo Grounds dedicated to him. That plaque has a real mythology to it because it disappeared, and it's you know, supposedly turns up over time, but it's not really it. I would love to see that tracked down and add something to its discovery because I think that's a really important artifact. That would be great. But that's a really good question. You know, I'm not that I can think of beyond that. I mean, there's always little artifacts and things, but I think this third edition of Roadside Baseball, it's so exhaustive. I mean, it really goes to so many lengths. To find things and mark places and track things down, you know, I'm really proud of it. But again, I'm always on the lookout and you never know. I mean, again, there are so many layers of this stuff when you think about how long baseball has been played in this country that, you know, I think there will be another edition in the next few years. And then I'll let you know. But again, nothing comes to top of mind where I feel like I've missed something. But that plaque, I think, would be wonderful to track down.
All right. And how about like guilty pleasures or things that, you know, to the casual fan or maybe the poor spouse that has to come along for the road trip with the sports fan driving that you would consider must see? Maybe not obvious, but like, you know, quintessentially worth the trip or the extra travel.
Well, I think everybody should go to spring training. We went a ton of times. I think go to either spring training just as an experience. That's still a nice way to experience baseball at a fairly eye level, you know, experience. I think the Louisville Slugger factory is wonderful and fun and a little crazy, whether you like baseball or not, and very interesting and very well done. That's a great spot. The Field of Dreams in Iowa, I think that's a great spot because, again, it's more than just about baseball. Cooperstown, certainly, not just for the Hall of Fame, but the town itself is so wonderful and charming. Again, that's an obvious one, but you'd be surprised. It's, you know, it's kind of in the middle of nowhere. I'm sure you've been there, but I think people, it behooves everybody to go to Cooperstown to really learn a lot about the United States, you know, not just about baseball. I think what I always encourage people to do when you go to a major league ballpark today, a lot of modern parks have become smart in that they will have some sort of historic display somewhere. But you've usually got to ask to find it. You know what I mean? If they don't trumpet it the way they do other things like the latest food or whatever. Always find out what kind of historic display or commemorative exhibit a ballpark might have. And you'll find some really cool stuff. Again, most parks do that today. San Francisco has a wonderful museum at their park. And so I like that parks have begun embracing that. So always check that out when you go to a modern park today. It makes for a nice little excursion.
Yeah. And if you're going to New York, right, you go to Yankee Stadium, there's this Monument Park, which is arguably the template for like how to do it. And it's been there, you know, in various forms and various forms of the stadium for years. I mean, literally, you got to wait in line. Right. And it's way out there in the center field, past the fence there. I'm not so sure at Citi Field. To be honest with you, I've never really kind of looked. And obviously, the Mets history pales in comparison, obviously, for the relative length of time versus that.
They've got a few things there, but you mentioned Yankee Stadium. When you go there, go to the field where the field used to be, you know, the original Yankee Stadium.
That's like a sand lot now for the youth there.
But keep in mind, when you find the main diamond, it's not, this kind of bothers me that it wasn't laid out to spec. Home plate is where second base is. So if you want to go stand where Lou Gehrig made the speech or where a million other things happen there at home plate, second base is the spot. And if you stand there, then you'll know that you're in that baseball vortex where so much happened at that home plate. That's the spot. All right, and so it's not marked or anything like that.
Yeah. So that sort of leads me to maybe one of my sort of last questions is that almost feels to me like the quintessential, like, you know, backbone for adventures like this is like to find that like home plate in all these different places. Right. So like we know at Ebbets Field, it's like, it's now at the foot of where it's like the apartment complex and all that kind of stuff in Minneapolis in Bloomington, where the old Met Stadium used to be, Metropolitan Stadium. I guess it's now literally in the wall of the Mall of America, right?
Yeah, well, it's in Camp Snoopy. And then what they did that was cool is they put an old seat from the ballpark, I think 460 feet away up on the wall where a Harmon Killebrew home run landed. So if you're at that plate, you can see the seat. And I think that's very cool. Hilltop Park in New York, there's a hospital there. They've marked home plate. There is some, one of the great ones is where Forbes Field used to be, University of Pittsburgh. Their home plate sits in a hallway where it once sat. And a huge portion of the outfield wall is 450 feet away out in the park. So you've got that there as well. So there are, you know, I outline all of these in the book about, you know, I love, again, it started with stadiums. It'll end with stadiums for me of what remnants are left. You know, Crosley Field in Cincinnati, they've got a little home plate marker and there's a community center there. And in the room, there's a table where second base used to be. And there's a little plaque on it that says, this is where the Beatles played because the stage is where this table was. So, you know, sometimes it gets even beyond baseball, which is kind of fun as well.
I guess the only real sort of set of questions I've got for you going forward, we could go on about like specific regions and cities and idiosyncrasies and stuff. It's a guidebook. It's a resource book. It's a reference title. There's all of those things into one. And I don't think even you have to be a baseball fan per se to enjoy it because it's also roadside America and all that kind of stuff, quintessentially. But let me ask you this, I guess, the last set of questions. So given the success of this book and potentially a newer version to come since 2019, that's been plenty of time for more changes. What of maybe expanding into other realms, like say a documentary or a travel series or a streaming series or getting into GPSs and creating tours and travel kinds of things and stuff.
Yeah.
It seems like you've got fodder to do that should you have the entrepreneurial will to do so.
Totally. And it's been discussed more times than I can frustratingly, but can even describe. The documentary thing's been on the table for a long time as a series, as a documentary. That's not over yet. It's really not. And I would love for that to happen. I think having an app, a roadside baseball app, is a natural. So to answer your question, yes, I do want this to be more of a visual experience for people. And there's certainly enough content there to do it. And it's just a matter of finding the right partner. But yeah, there's been so much conversation about it over the years. And that is definitely on my to-do list. I appreciate you bringing it up because it is, you're right. I mean, it does lend itself to that. And I've been thinking about that for a long time. So absolutely.
Yeah, some inspiration. I mean, I don't think it's on Peacock now because he's out of contract. But Dale Earnhardt Jr. did two seasons during his NBC tour. I think he's out of contract with NBC. Hopefully, get it resigned. But they took all of his shows off the Peacock in the interim. But he had a series called Lost Speedways, which is his personal passion project, and he literally goes to places that, you know, you could barely eke out maybe where the track and the stands were, to literally things that were still kind of standing and just had been abandoned and nobody's been around, but the structures are there and you can, you know,
I loved that. And yeah. I will tell you something. This, we had right before COVID, a couple of really big names, Hollywood names, stepped up to take roadside baseball and develop it. And things were falling into place so quickly and so excitingly. And then COVID hit and everything went away. And so a couple of them were still interested. In the last 6 months or so, I can't give away too much, but I will tell you that what I was working on with Tommy Lasorda up until the time he died is we are developing that now as we speak into something really exciting and very visual. And so the subject of roadside baseball came up within that project, and hopefully once the Tommy thing is all done and on the air and all that, we will, the same team will gravitate back toward roadside baseball. And there's a very big sports name involved within it who really love that idea. So hopefully this will, if we talk again, we can talk about that.
All right. So if it gets closer to fruition, you promise you'll come back and perhaps give us more an insight.
But you got to tell me your connection to New York ballparks first.
My connection. Oh, please. Not that it matters. My family, basically, it was willed to me that I had to be a Yankees fan. And this is on both sides. So my paternal grandfather was in the wholesale liquor business, right? Mm-hmm. First generation from Italy, you know, proverbial dollar in his pocket, and became sort of one of the biggest distributors in the northern New Jersey, New York City metropolitan area. And one of his biggest clients was Ballantine Ale, which for many years was the preferred lager of said New York Yankees. That was my maternal side. My paternal side, my grandfather was one of the top reps for Topps baseball cards. And his biggest account was, wait for it, the New York Yankees. So I grew up sort of in a generation, you know, sort of beyond all that. But there were plenty of icons in my upbringing, whether they be posters or plaques and signed baseballs and visits to Yankee Stadium. The first ever baseball game, of course, was Yankee Stadium itself. But I tell you, in the mid 80s, when I was sort of a certain age, 17 or so, it was very hard not to get caught up in the underdog story, right, of the Mets at that time.
Right.
Obviously culminating at 86 with the World Series.
I was at the Buckner game, by the way.
Okay. Well, there you go. I was not, but, clearly.
I have my ticket. My ticket sits right here on my desk. It's never left me.
And you know the mania it was because the Mets very rarely were in that kind of position, right? 69 and then. Right. Maybe 73, they didn't win, you know, but whatever. So I guess I would have to say, if push comes to shove, I grew up a Yankee fan, obviously a New York Giants football fan. Usually those two go in tandem. And the Mets and the Jets tended to, for at least for a period of time, be kind of connoted with another type of fan too. But I'll admit, I kind of switched allegiances only because of the underdog element with the Mets versus the Yankees, which, you know, is just, you know, feels like a kingdom. And but, you know, I've taken my 86 year old dad to a couple of games in the quote unquote new stadium. And it was just a great opportunity to kind of, you know, I don't think you can replicate that in Citi Field. And we're going to try that this summer. We'll see if the same vibes happen. I doubt it.
Can I tell you one last thing that I was thinking about here?
Please.
Tommy Lasorda, there was a story that I told him that he would make me recount for other people, that he was left him in utter disbelief. And this was something in roadside. It's probably one of my favorite top five sites in roadside baseball. And it's a little plaque in LA on a golf course at the 18th hole in Griffith Park. And the part, what the plaque says is it marks what it calls the birth of the curse, because that's where Babe Ruth became a Yankee. And Tommy Lasorda couldn't believe that practically within a stone's throw of Dodger Stadium. And the story was, you know, Ruth left New York that winter, I believe in 1919, early 1920, and they sent Miller Huggins out to track him down and let him know he'd been sold and have him sign the contract. And that's where Huggins found him, was at the 18th hole. And that's where he signed it. And that's where the plaque is. And it's so incongruous to think of Babe Ruth becoming a Yankee in LA more than 100 years ago, you know, and that little plaque to me is so important and so interesting to think of. That's where the legacy started. And a lot of people don't realize that. You mentioned the beer at ball games. When Babe Ruth was a Yankee, that's during Prohibition. There was not a beer sold at Yankee Stadium when Babe Ruth played there. Prohibition essentially ends, I think, a year after he ends. So there's no, he didn't really, people went to see him. It was all like a straight crowd, you know, save for what might have been snuck in. But people don't realize that when Ruth was a Yankee, part of which is why he became a Yankee was to help, you know, the owner with the beer company kind of still make money.
No, it's fat. And look, we can pull on this string forever.
Right? I know.
Just more and more and more to just uncover. And that's why this book is so great, because frankly, you can also take it with you, right? Like business travel and stuff, it's just like, okay, I happen to be in Cleveland for a business trip this week. Hey, maybe I should, and I got a rental car. Maybe I'll take a few extra.
Every week from that person who's like, hey, you know what? I just want to thank you. I had time before lunch. I went and I got to see, you know, a plaque where the home plate was at Riverfront Stadium, whatever. That's how a lot of people use it like that. And I love that. Ken Burns, what did he say? I mean, he said that many years ago, I imagine this book in the glove compartment of every true fan's car. And that's what it became, was like, a travel Bible, you know, and those are the notes I get from people that are out there hunting these places down. So it's been fun to help facilitate those experiences.
Okay, the book is called Roadside Baseball. It's the third edition of said tome. The subtitle is The Locations of America's Baseball Landmarks, a reference book to be had and enjoyed and highly recommended by yours truly. It is by our guest this week, Chris Epting, with a foreword by Joe Buck. And it is available wherever good books are found. Perhaps your local independent bookseller down the street is one way to get it. It is published by Santa Monica Press. You could also get it, of course, a wink, wink, and a nod, nod on our website at goodseatsstillavailable.com. You just search up this episode number 343. With Chris, and you'll find a convenient link or two to the book. We'll get a couple of nickels or dimes of referral love from the good folks at Amazon, and you'll get the paperback or Kindle version, or perhaps even a used copy of one of the previous editions, if you're into that kind of thing, courtesy of Amazon. And we thank you for doing that in that that method. If you feel inclined to do that, you can follow more about Chris Epting at his website at Chris Epting, that's C-H-R-I-S, Epting, E-P-T-I-N-G, chrisepting.com. You can follow him on Twitter/X, also at Chris Epting. That's Chris, C-H-R-I-S, Epting, E-P-T-I-N-G, at Chris Epting. Pretty easy. And I got to tell you, we kind of hinted at it in the conversation, but Roadside Baseball is just not the only book that Chris has penned. You're going to find on his website a whole bunch of things. For example, if you're interested in the story of Dave Mason, guitarist and musician extraordinaire, he wrote the biography of him. If you're into the Doobie Brothers, you'd like to read the book Long Train Runnin', which is co-authored by Tom Johnston and Pat Simmons of the band. He wrote that, Chris Epting did. How about Leif Garrett? You want the Idle Truth, I-D-O-L, Truth, a memoir. Well, he helped co-write that with Leif Garrett. That's a fascinating story, too. Maybe even the story of John Oates, also available, a writing by Chris Epting. There's a whole bunch of other stuff. Chris is an interesting cat with lots of different interests and areas of literary adventure awaiting for you at chrisepting.com. Buy one, buy them all, but they're all really interesting. And of course, this one was especially for us. If you're online, again, our website, goodseatsstillavailable.com. We post and stream all of our episodes there. Of course, if you want to get the latest episode the minute it drops, of course, you got to find or follow us or subscribe to us wherever you get good podcasts. We're available wherever you can find them, with the exception now of Google Podcasts, which is going to go away in a couple of days. So if you're subscribed there, make sure you find another podcast player, because Google is going away in that regard. They're going to move all their podcast stuff to their YouTube music service. So there's one place, but there are a whole bunch of others, of course. Find us on social media. You'll find us on Twitter/X at Good Seats Still. You'll find us on Instagram at Good Seats Still Available. You'll find us on Threads at Good Seats Still Available. You'll also find us on Facebook at Good Seats Still Available. If you'd like to send us some email, you can do that. We're at hello@goodseatsstillavailable.com. Our thanks, as always, to Jerry Payne. Jerry Payne Audio Excellence, thank you, fine sir, or kind sir, or both of those, fine, kind sir, for knob-twiddling your heart out this week. We appreciate that. Don't know what else, but, oh, yeah, I know what else. How about we do this? Let's leave you with a little little baseball humor for you as you're traveling the roadside looking for some of these stops along the way with this book. How about Abbott Costello and Who's On First? Take care of yourselves. See you next week.
Friends, I told you that my partner would be here, and here he is. Didn't you expect him, did you? Now, he always shapes up. Now, why not let the folks themselves ask for something that they'd like to hear?
All right, what would they like to hear?
Something different. Now, okay. Is there anything special that you would like to hear us do?
Baseball.
Wait a minute, friends. You don't want to hear that, do you?
Yeah, we got the props for you here. Oh, you came prepared, didn't you?
All set, huh? Well, this is a must. I guess it's a must. We've got to do it. Well, I'll tell you what we'll do. Let me see. It looks all right.
Okay, all right.
Now, we'll pretend. We'll just pretend. All right, I'll take it easy with that. We'll just pretend that we're organizing a baseball team here at the retired actor's home. And I am the manager. Now...
You're going to be the manager of the retired actors baseball team?
Yes.
I would like to join the retired actors baseball team.
Oh, you would?
And I would like to know some of the guys' names on the team, so if I want to play with them, I know them, and I meet them on the street or in the home here, I can say hello to them.
Oh, sure. But you know, they give baseball players nowadays very peculiar names.
I know, a lot of funny names.
You know, like Sticky Fields.
Sticky Fields.
Goofy Dan.
Boopy Barber.
Booby Barber.
I know all of them.
But let's see, now, we have on our team, we have Who's On First, What's On Second, I Don't Know's On Third.
That's what I want to find out, the guy's name. That's what I want to find out, the guy's name.
I'm telling you, Who's On First, What's On Second, I Don't Know's On Third.
Now, Abby, you going to be the manager of the baseball team?
Yes.
You know the guy's names?
Well, I should.
Well, now, you tell me the guy's names on the baseball team.
I say, Who's On First, What's On Second, I Don't Know's On Third.
You ain't saying nothing to me yet. Go ahead and tell me.
I'm telling him.
You ain't said nothing yet. Go ahead and tell me.
Who's on first, what's on second, I don't know, is on third.
You know the guy's name on the baseball team?
Yes.
Well, go ahead. Who's on first?
Yes.
I mean the guy's name.
Who?
The guy playing first.
Who?
The guy playing first base.
Who?
The guy on first base.
Who is on first?
What are you asking me for? I don't know.
Now, wait a minute. I'm not
I'm asking you who's on first.
That's his name.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
Who?
The guy on first.
That's it. That's his name.
Well, you ain't said nothing. I ain't asked you nothing.
You did.
You know the guy's name on first base?
Sure.
Well, tell me the guy's name on first base.
Who?
The guy playing first base.
Who is on first, Lou?
What are you asking me for?
Now, don't get excited. I'm saying who...
I'm asking you a simple question. Who's on first?
Yes.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
That's it.
That's who? Yeah. I'm asking you, what's the guy's name on first base?
Oh, no, what's on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
One base at a time.
Don't mix up my...
I'm not mixing up anybody. Now, what's the guy's name on first base?
No, what is on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who is on first?
I don't know.
He's on third. We're not talking...
Whoa. How did I get on third base?
You mentioned his name.
I mentioned his name?
Yes.
I don't know anybody's name on the team. How could I mention a guy's name?
You did. You just mentioned it.
All right. What's the guy's name on third base?
No, what's on second?
Who's on second?
Who's on first?
I don't know.
He's on first.
You know what I mean? I didn't even mention a guy's name on third base.
Yes, you did.
All right, then. Who's playing third base?
No, who's on first?
I'm not asking you what's on first.
What's on second?
Who's on second?
Who's on first?
I don't know. He's third base. I don't know anybody on a baseball team.
You do. You mention their names.
I do?
Sure.
You got an outfield?
What,
Naturally.
Now, let's feel his name.
Why?
I just thought I'd ask you.
Well, I just thought I'd tell you.
Well, go ahead. Tell me.
Tell you what?
Tell a feeler's name.
Why?
Because I want to know. Because.
Oh, he's center field. You know these players as well.
Who's
as
in center field?
No, who's on first?
What's on first?
What's on second?
I don't know. Third base. Do you know the guy's names on the team?
Look, Louis, you don't seem to understand. See, I have a first baseman.
I asked you, what's the first baseman's name?
No, what's the second baseman's
name? I'm going to stop asking you, sir. I asked you, what's the first baseman's name?
What's the second baseman's
name? I don't even get past the first. All right, who's on second?
Who's on first?
What base do you want to talk about?
You talk about anyone you want to talk about.
All right, now who's on first?
Right.
Okay.
No.
All right, you got a first baseman.
Yes.
When you pay off the first baseman every month, who gets the money?
Every dollar of it. Every dollar of it.
Who gets it?
He does. Sometimes his wife comes down and collects it.
Whose wife?
Yes. Why not, Lou? He's earned it.
Who did?
Yes.
Look, when you pay off the first base every month, you get a receipt from the guy?
Sure.
How does he sign his name?
Who?
The guy you give the money to.
Who?
The guy you give the money to.
Well, that's how he signs it.
That's
Lou.
How who signs it?
Yes.
Who guy tell me?
That's it.
Who? Look, you go to first base.
Yes.
And you say to him, here's your money, sign the receipt. How does he sign his name?
Who?
The guy you give the money to.
That's how he signs it.
That's how who signs it?
Yes.
Sure. You gotta get a receipt from the guy, don't you?
Get one, Lou.
How does the guy on first base sign his name?
Who?
The guy on first.
That's how he signs
it. I'm asking, when you give the guy the money, what's the guy's name that you give the money to?
Now, wait a minute. What signs his own?
Who signs his own?
No, who signs his?
I mean, what's the guy's name on first you get
what the... What is on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
I don't know.
Third base.
The fielder's name, the center field. I don't know if... You got a pitcher on the team?
Well, this would be a fine team without a pitcher.
It's a fine team. What is the pitcher's name?
Tomorrow. I can't change that name.
You don't want to tell me the day?
I'm telling you.
Go ahead. Tell me the pitcher's name.
Tomorrow.
Why not tell me today?
Tomorrow.
All right, what time tomorrow you tell me the pitcher's name?
What time what?
What time tomorrow you're going to tell me who's pitching?
Who is not pitching?
I'll break you around, you see. Who's on first? I want to know what's the pitcher's name.
What's on second?
I don't know. Third base. You got a catcher?
Certainly you've got a catcher on a baseball team.
Catcher's name?
Today.
Today. Tomorrow's pitching, today's catcher.
Now you've got it.
Now I got it. All I got, we got a couple of days on the team, that's all.
I can't help that, Lou. I don't
You know, I'm a pretty good catcher myself.
And so they tell me.
Yeah, now I get behind the plate and I'm going to do some fancy catching, and tomorrow's pitching on my team, right?
Yeah.
Now tomorrow he winds up the ball and I'm behind the plate and the heavy hitter gets up.
Yeah.
Now the heavy hitter gets up and he's ready to hit the ball, and tomorrow's going to throw the ball and I'm the catcher. Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to tomorrow throws the ball, the guy that bunts the ball. Now, when he bunts the ball, me being a good catcher, I want to throw the guy out of first base, so I pick up the ball and throw it to who?
Now, that's the first thing you've said right.
I don't even know what I'm talking about!
Well, that's all you have to do.
Is to throw the ball at first base.
Yes.
Now, who's got it?
Naturally.
Sure. Look, the guy is running at first base, yeah. Ivan. I want to throw the guy out.
So?
So I throw the ball to who?
Naturally.
Throw it to who?
Naturally.
And who's got it?
Naturally.
So I pick up the ball and I throw it to Natural.
No. You throw the ball to first base, then who gets it?
Naturally.
That's it. Now you're
sure, same thing. Right. I pick up the ball, so I throw it to Natural.
You don't.
I throw it to who?
Naturally.
That's what I'm saying! I said I throw the ball to who?
Naturally.
You ask me.
You throw the ball to who?
Naturally. Same as you!
Say it that way.
I throw the ball to Natural.
You don't. You throw it to who?
Now who's got it? Naturally. That's what I said. Right. Whoever it is, better get it. That's
He'll
all
get
I can
it. Don't
you.
Worry about who. Who'll get it?
Yes. He better get it.
All right.
Now, I throw the ball to whoever it is, drops the ball so the guy runs a second. Yeah. Who picks up the ball and throws it to what? What throws it? I don't know. Throws it back to tomorrow. Triple play.
Could be.
Another guy gets up and it's a long fly ball to because. Why? I don't know. He's on third and I don't give a darn. I said, I don't give a darn.
Oh, that's our shortstop.
I mean, he didn't give a darn.